89.5 FM, WBAI, available on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, along with Roberta Maria Atti.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. How are you?
I am fine, Armand, and there is an echo. I believe something is wrong with the engineering.
No, I don't think there is. No, let me put back the theme. We'll check in with Michael.
Yeah.
All right, we're back with you. Now, how's that, Roberta?
That's fine. It was a problem with my engineering.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that you've been doing today, running from place to place. It's kind of amazing.
I've been having fun.
Listen, let's talk about this. This is very important. The idea of what depression is. The idea about all pathologies. You know, pathologies is a word that we use in psychiatry that means not normal. Means not normal. Means that people have certain things that they do. Obsessive compulsive disorder. You know what that is. You can't get your mind off something. You can't stop yourself from doing certain things. They consider that outside the normal range. Psychopathy. Here's another one. A word that means you have no conscience. That you could do anything you want and feel like you could do anything you want. And there's no awareness of the consequences of your behavior as they impact on somebody else. You don't care. Paranoia. You think that somebody's out to get you. You believe that there are things that want to hurt you, or you imagine things are trying to hurt you. A whole bunch of things that the human mind is capable of. And one wonders, how come some minds are normal, average, and some minds are not? Well, of course, the people whose minds are not normal would love to glorify the minds that are not normal. They would say, because it's all wonderful. It's a spiritual gift. I'd like to take a look at these pathologies, not as good or bad, but as adaptations, and I think something we could learn a great deal about. And I'd like to start this one with the idea of depression and what depression is. Let's think about depression, okay? We're going to talk first about a yogi. They put a yogi. Have you ever seen yogis being buried or being isolated in tombs?
No, I have read about it, though.
How many hours can a yogi go?
Days.
They could go days on enough breath that would last the average person 1, 2, 3 hours.
Yeah, I don't think they breathe, actually. They reduce it to such a low level that it's almost nothing.
If you could do that to your body, if you can will your body to depress your breathing, then that's quite a power you have. So what is depressed breathing? Why is the body capable of depressed breathing? A man is found out in a tsunami, 10 days at sea. They pick up this survivor. He's barely breathing, but he survived. And he's going to survive. Badly dehydrated, floating around for 10 days. How did he get through that?
You know, Armand, that there's a statistic that shows that depressed people live longer. It's one of the recent things that has come up, that depressed people have long lives. It's very strange. The quality of life may not be very good, but depression puts the brain in a state of equilibrium when stressful circumstances cause the person to suffer.
Or maybe imagined stressful circumstances. Let's take a look back at what its purpose could be, okay? Of course, many people say it's just chemical imbalance. Well, what does chemical imbalance mean? It means, let's say you have too much of one hormone or too much of another, or you have a reason to have a surge in hormones. The body looks at it and says, too much, I can't handle this. Let's take away the primary hormone that's causing this, and the result is the person feels depressed. Now, this could be a serotonin imbalance, and it could simply mean the body doesn't like what's going on the way it is, and so it's coming in to change things. By removing that serotonin, you feel depressed. Is the depression serving a purpose? Well, maybe so, because maybe that hormone could be more damaging in the way that it's coming in than the depression is. At least the body is saying so. The body is saying, we can't have you this way. The body is saying, I've got to get you to survive, so I'm going to depress you. A whale, a dolphin, wants to take a breath and stay underwater longer. What do? They jump. We have a thing called the splash reflex. A splash reflex is the kind of when water hits you across the face. It will drop your metabolism. And why would you want to drop your metabolism? To stay underwater longer. Swimmers who are long-distance swimmers, or swimmers who are going to swim underwater, they always dive into the water. They dive to get the splash on their face because it drops the metabolism so that they use less oxygen and they can swim greater distances underwater. So the whole idea that the body has an ability to depress itself is first what we look at and recognize as a pretty marvelous thing. That's pretty wonderful. Now we look at it and we say, yes, but we don't want to be depressed when we don't want to be depressed. And the body is saying, we want you to be depressed because we can't think of an alternative. So what's good about depression? What does it do? How does it serve us? Well, I think depression is like a midpoint between life and death. If you look at depressed people, they generally look dispirited. It looks like the spirit of life is missing. Now, what does that do for you? Why would we want to be there? And I think it relates to the body perceiving potential death and the body saying, well, we can't keep you fully alive, so we're going to have to keep you near death. I think depression is living near death.
That's very interesting, Armand, and very well said. And yes, I believe through depression, one can explore a realm that is not available to the living. And also, one can do something that is by definition forbidden, because we're not supposed to think about death. We're not supposed to even acknowledge it. It's not good manners to indulge in the thought of death. So by breaking that rule, one feels a bit of autonomous thinking, you know, of a autonomous choice by doing something that one is not supposed to do. Also, I have observed that when a person is severely depressed and life has nothing or seems to have nothing in the perception of the person worth living, by sitting by the side of death, sitting right at the edge of death, one kind of looks over onto the other side. And one can create images on the other side that are not possible to create on that, in life, because reality is what it is and you can't change it. Reality in the life of a person is what it is.
Wait, let me try to understand this.
Okay.
When somebody, I can't imagine the person sitting. When somebody is depressed, what side are they looking at?
They are sitting in life. They're alive. They are depressed. So they're sitting in a room, maybe a dark room. They are depressed. And they are imagining death. Because a lot of people, when they are depressed, indulge in thoughts of death. And this is, I think, a form of creating in the fantasy something that they cannot create in real life.
Why would they want to do that?
Because they feel impotent in real life to create what they think that would make them happy. So they sit at the edge of death, and since death is the other side, there's no access to it, therefore you have the freedom to imagine whatever you want about it, then onto the other side is like opening a window onto a realm of possibilities. And if you look at death with that imagery, then you can create, for instance, a heaven where everything you want may be there. Everything you hope to have may be there. And that, for people, brings relief. For some people, brings relief.
Well, not many people feel relief from their depression that way, because the thoughts become obsessional. And when the thoughts are obsessional, you get kind of caught in the middle of it. It's not a happy place. It's not an unhappy. It is an unhappy place. Dang. Depression is very unhappy. So what you're doing with your mind at that point, once you get depressed, your mind truly is dysfunctional. It works on focusing on the dark side, and it kind of works on itself, because what happens is the more you focus on the dark side, the more depressed you get. There's no way, of course, people always advise people, get up, get out, go do something in life, because they're saying, don't lean on that side. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We are talking about how psychological functioning sometimes serves in an unusual way, how depression itself maybe the body is the body's attempt at keeping you going. Let's use this as an example. A child is being beaten, psychologically, physically. Either way, they're being berated by some parent who's yelling and screaming at them, or they're being hit. Now, there's a child who is powerless and small, and if they would just be alive, they would start screaming and yelling and hollering. Which, in the world of savagery, if something is screaming and yelling and hollering, you generally tend to beat it more and try to kill it. So animals learn to hide their wounds. A child is being beaten. A child wants to hide its wound. It doesn't want to keep going because it knows it will get more beaten. So the child becomes silent. What power the human mind has to have that child go completely numb through a production of endorphins that will go shooting through its body so that the person feels nothing, and closing down the mind and the perception so the child doesn't take in the full reality that they are being beaten or so unloved. Even if it's a verbal beating, the mind will shut itself down. Now, on top of that, what happens is anyone who is being beaten as a child, berated, also gets angry. It's the nature of any animal. If you ever saw a kitten suddenly get angry, a kitten, you know, you don't expect them to suddenly start hissing. But if you fool around with them too much, or if a child plays with them, they're going to react. They're going to react with anger. So if a person feels anger, but knows that that anger and the expression of that anger could lead to actual physical death, what's a child to do? They depress themselves. Depression is always the result of anger turned against the self. So in this psychological mechanism, the human body is trying to take care of you. It's saying to you, you can't afford to get angry in this situation, nor can you afford to get angry in any situation because you're too weak. So what we're going to do is we're going to shut down your perception. We won't even let you think anger. Every time you think anger, we'll turn your anger against you. We'll make you think it's your fault. Now this makes the body and the mind work together to keep a person not from crossing over to the other side of life, which is death, but somewhere in the middle. In order to stay in that middle, you need to keep the thoughts going. Now, in order to keep the thoughts going that keep you depressed, that's where obsessional thinking comes in. That's where ruminating comes in. That's where you sit around and you just sink deeper and deeper and deeper into this world, till eventually you get closer and closer to death. Now, what I agree with you on, Roberta, is this thing about, you know, the iceberg theory. That there's a person who is depressed is somewhere caught in this floating iceberg, you know, and they have this, the top of the iceberg is their way out of the depression, but there is such a mass underneath the water, that they are going to go underneath into the depression. And sometimes people get so depressed that they spontaneously come out of it. They have felt it fully. Other ways that people get undepressed is they try to discover emotionally what they could do for themselves. What's the missing piece? You know, it's very simple in psychology. The easiest thing in the world, a person comes in depressed. You, the therapist, know, oh, they're angry, but they can't get in touch with that anger. So the therapist always knows how to fix depression. And he knows exactly what the process is. But if a person doesn't do it on their own and they don't seek a therapist, they may go to a physician. And a physician says this interesting thing. Let's give you a pill. Now, an interesting thing happens when a depressed person who has a body who's telling them, you must stay depressed, you must hang out in this middle zone between life and death, and then we give you a pill that changes your chemistry such that your mind lifts above the mandate of the body. One of the things that people report are high incidence of suicidal thoughts. Because they're still hanging out with death. But the pill has kind of chemically taken them away from their depressive hangout. So now this very interesting complex thing happens. You're in the middle. Your body is telling you, be depressed. It's good for you. You have a chemical that takes you out of the depression. And there you are. Suddenly you're lost. Suspended. And what happens to all the people who take these pills, which for many people have saved lives, I believe, what happens to them is they become kind of numb. They walk around in a middle zone, which is preferable to being deeply depressed.
One of the things you said, Armand, about this anger turned inward is that sometimes when a depressed individual feels that, and it feels the power of this self-destructive energy, it is safer to stay depressed because that extra energy in the body, unless it's under control of the mind, could turn against in a real act of self-harm. But if the body is very low energy and there's very little desire to move and there's very little desire to go out and talk to people, it's difficult to even find the means to find that energy, to find the ways to do something to hurt the self. But I also think that there is a cultural taboo that says we're not allowed to think about it, we're not allowed to talk about it, so death is forbidden, and if you hang out by it, you're wrong and bad. So then the person ends up in guilt. Because if I am a person who dares to look onto the other side and speculate and wonder and engage whatever the thoughts are about the other side, then I must be bad. And then guilt comes in and shame that compounds
the
problem.
Well, you see, both guilt and shame are thinking processes. They're thinking processes that perpetuate the depression itself.
Exactly right.
So it's like, it's not that these things come in. It's like as soon as you step out, as soon as, like you're saying, as soon as you think of stepping out of the depression, like for example, if you think about expressing your anger, or as soon as you start thinking about even I'm going to commit suicide, the thoughts will come in to further entrap you. It is like a wonderful, remarkable, amazing mechanism of we, the frontal lobed
That's
beauties.
Exactly what I was going to say, that the guilt and shame in a way have the purpose of keeping the person depressed so that that extra energy that could translate into a self-actualized harm is not produced by the body, because the guilt and shame are the forces that keep it at bay. I was reading about these Aborigine in Australia. This is a tribe of people who has chosen not to reproduce. That's a form of group depression. You see, it's a tribe whereby every individual in the tribe experiences a kind of depression because their way of life is no longer allowed by the society that surrounds them. So their form of depression is not the individual being depressed, it's the tribe being depressed. And collectively they make a choice whereby they're not going to reproduce. These are a few individuals and they are the last of that group and there's not going to be any child. And then when these individuals live, and while they're living, they're not depressed individually, then they get to a point where something inside them says it's time. And they simply lie down, close their eyes, stop eating, stop drinking, and eventually they die. But there is no suffering involved with that death, neither of the individual who chooses it nor of the group who witnesses it. There's no mourning, there's no grief. So culturally, I think we need to also be aware that a lot of the depression that people experience in our society is kind of a little bit of their response, or at least is interwoven with the myths and the archetypes and the common unconscious that we are steeped in. And in a different culture, depression may not be seen at all as a pathology, may be seen as a way of life.
So depression itself is certainly, and I think you bring up something very important. When we talk about refugee syndrome and we talk about people who are refugees, depression goes along with the refugee syndrome to get your body to kind of survive getting to the next pit stop. You know, I mean, you're just trying to find the place you belong. Concentration camps during the Second World War. Depression was the primary tool that people use to get through day to day. See? Depression, looking at it on the inside. One of the things that happen a lot, a great deal, is there's a certain amount of wisdom that comes in depression. And I know very often someone will consult with me and they'll say to me, there are two things I know. And this is every person who's depressed feels this way. Number one, life itself is meaningless, is what they discover. They discover that there is no real reason for life itself. That they're just kind of, you know, repeating things and that we're just here on some kind of a treadmill and life is meaningless. And then, in addition to that, their second thought is, my life is meaningless. Now, on a big scale, if you look at this spiritually, cosmologically, yeah, of course life is meaningless. Of course, if we look at the major connection, if we look at the universe and we look at our little motions and what does it matter whether you get your Starbucks coffee or not, you know, in the big scheme of things, life is meaningless. And your life, if you look at it in the big scale of the scheme of things, is meaningless. Now, that could be okay. If you're a Buddhist, that's fine. If you have philosophical beliefs that think that everything is united, that's fine. I could be meaningless. Now, the problem is, if you take that thought and you use that and say, therefore, I should not exist. See, that's where the depression sits in. But the reality, the perception of the depressed person is not so far from truth. So they're not so far away from what's real. Trouble is that with them thinking that way, they sink closer and closer to death itself. Mm-hmm. You know, aging, I was looking at some people who are getting older. And as they're getting older, I'm watching there are a certain group of people, I'm sure you've seen this, Roberta, who are depressed. And then there's another group of people as they get older who are not depressed.
Sure.
The ones who are depressed, there was a woman crossing the street the other day. And as she was walking, I was watching her walking, and I said, she's just waiting to die. There's a certain depression that comes with later life. That could be, I'm preparing myself to go out on the ice. You know, I'm preparing myself to leave this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another that says, I'm not going to leave yet. Now, I'm not going to say which is better, because I think if a person is ready to leave, they're ready to leave. I love life, and I love people staying alive for a long period of time. But depression becomes part of aging. You know, it's almost like, okay, so now you don't reproduce anymore, and now you don't do this anymore. Now you just, you know, get ready to move on.
Sure. When you speak and you give that description, I also think of animals I've seen like that. Dogs and cats and horses, animals in zoos that have had their freedom taken away. They just kind of sit there, and you can tell that they're just waiting for time to go by without anything that, just waiting for death, like you just said.
You remember Sydney?
Yeah, Sydney, of course. Of course, I think
Let's tell people about Sydney.
Oh, Sydney. Oh, Sidney was my guardian angel in many ways. He was a great Pyrenees who weighed 150 pounds, and I rescued him when he was 1 year old. And when I saw him, he looked like a bear, and he kept looking like a bear his entire life. He was white and huge and gentle and fierce and noble and the most generous creature I've ever met and the most faithful. And Sidney helped me raise my children. Sidney guarded the house, and Sidney had a cat and an iguana and a ferret to watch over, because he was a sheepdog, so he needed a herd of something to watch over. So he had us, the people, and he had these other animals. And he did a job that was outstanding. And then when he was about 14 years old, I put him in a van, and him and I drove across country, and I took him to see the Grand Canyon and the mountains in Arizona, in Sedona, and we went coast to coast. And we even saw a ball lightning in the sky one night, him and I, which we did not know what it was. It was this great blue ball of turquoise light that crossed the sky and lit up the night with this blue light. It was unbelievable, and I thought that UFOs were coming, but it was a ball lightning. And him and I saw this, and I'll never forget the time when I took him into the Grand Canyon at dawn. And I had never seen it, and he had never seen it, and he could not see that well anymore because he was old already. But we got into the canyon itself, and I was breathless with the beauty of the dawn in the canyon, but I could see Sidney's nose twitching and his ears going up and all of his old, old senses perking up. He sensed the beauty and the majesty of what he was in front of, even though he could not see it. He had that sense. And Sidney was the kind of creature that one encounters once in a lifetime. And yes, at some point he started to wait for his death.
And he got depressed. I mean, he
yes,
was,
he did.
You could see the depression
yes,
there, and you see he was waiting to die. And I remember you used to move him along,
help
him up a ramp to get into the car. And
right.
And you were with him right there every inch of the way. And
Oh, yeah. And I used to kiss him and tell him I loved him. But he was depressed for the last year of his life, because I think he couldn't use his beautiful body anymore. And that was difficult for him.
And so what happened, though, is like we're saying, you know, this is that little crossover place. And Sidney stuck around long enough for you guys. I'm sure if Sidney wanted to, if he had a choice, he might have left a little earlier.
Of course he could have left a little earlier, and it would have been a lot easier for him, because he would have suffered a lot less towards the end when he was old. He had a lot of aches and pains, but he stuck around by being depressed, because he wanted to make sure that I was taken care of. See, he was my guardian angel, and he was worried if he should leave, what would happen to me.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're talking about some of the psychological phenomena that everybody jumps on nowadays, depression being one. There are other things that I have discovered about different pathologies, you know, about why, for example, do we have a psychopath in our culture? Why do we have somebody who disregards all the rules and is willing to kill, hurt, and not care at all about everybody else? Why do we have some, you know, people who decide that they're just going to kill people? Why do we have that? Well, those are some of the questions that we're going to approach, because I think that we're seeing a lot more than just individual damage. I think we're seeing something that I think has many lessons for us. Depression being one that, of course, I want nobody to have to live with, because it's such a bad feeling. But I think it's not understood enough, and I think before we start ripping it out of people with SSRIs and drugs, we should understand its purpose a little better. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're going to take a very short break, play a little music, and when we come back, we're going to continue with this discussion.
It begins here for me on this road. How the whole mess happened, I don't know. But I know it couldn't happen again in a million years.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi. 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 WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
pretty hot stuff. It's called Stiff Jazz. From an album, I don't even think it's published yet, called Saint-Germain-des-Prés Café. Saint-Germain.
Saint-Germain-des-Prés.
I know, but Saint-Germain-des-Prés Café, number 5. Quite an interesting album, a lot of unique things on it. This is Armand DeMille with you with Roberta Atti, The Positive Mind. We're looking at some of the things that we have in life. I want to go back to that question. There's a question about a pathology. One is with, oh, in case you just tuned in, we talk about people and how people function. So we're talking about some of these things that people see as only aberrations, and they've got to be gotten rid of, but nobody thinks about, why is this here? What is the purpose? If we take it away, what's going to happen? Let me talk about obsessive-compulsive disorder for a moment, a very interesting thing. Obsessing about something where you can't get something off your mind, and you just can't get your mind out of it. Every time I have ever worked with anybody who's got an obsessive-compulsive disorder, I find one common root, and it's just amazing. The common root is their sexuality. Something happens. Most obsessive-compulsive disorders that I have ever seen really set in somewhere around teenage years. Now, what is that combination? What's that about? Let's go back to obsessive-compulsive disorder. If you've got it, my friends, SSRIs, these Prozacs, they work incredibly well at reducing it. That's if you want to say to yourself, I'm not going to do any other effort to do it. I'm going to take these pills. I'm going to change my scope on life. It kind of changes your chemistry, you know? Makes you look at life a little different, makes you feel different. You may not feel as alive. You may not feel... Well, one of the interesting things about these drugs is they make you feel less sexual. So why does obsessive-compulsive disorder yield so well to the serotonin reuptake inhibitors? Well, there's an interesting link, because I have always found if you talk to somebody about the beginning of their obsessions, they will tell you that at adolescence, it started happening. And you will see where they were having sexual thoughts, sexual urges, where the hormones were surging in their body, and the body must have looked at it, the mind, the mastermind must have looked at it and said, no, don't think about this, think about that instead. And say, look, you know, are you sure you're safe in this house? Maybe you should check and see if the windows are locked. Small thing. There you are feeling some kind of sexual hormonal surge, but it's not good because everything in your house says this is not a good thing to have. People are being prohibitive. People are saying you shouldn't be a certain way. So your mind looks for an answer. What am I going to do with all these hormones inside me? I'll worry about safety. I'll see if the windows are shut. I'll keep checking the windows. I'll keep checking the doors. No, I don't know what to do with that. I'll take another one. I'll fall in love with somebody. You fall in love. This way you can keep both your sexuality and your mind obsessed on something. The obsessive compulsive mind is dealing with an adolescent sexuality that's out of control. Seems to be the case, and nobody would ever believe this, but the evidence is with the SSRIs, with Prozac and stuff like that being so effective and working specifically at controlling sexual hormones. The serotonin part in sexual arousing, how much does serotonin play a part of it?
I think it plays a part in the sense that in order to have a harmonious sexual life or sexuality, one has to have both hemispheres of the brain oscillating in syntony, in synchronicity, synergistically, whereas what you're describing is a surge of hormones, Armand, in an adolescent that causes a shift in the hormonal balance to such an extent and so suddenly that it throws off the balance between the hemispheres. And if the child has already experienced a lack of inner safety or security or structure or something, that surge is too much. It causes a sense of like a loss of footing underground, because it leaves one feeling almost naked, as you talked about sexuality, almost naked with these feelings, and it causes too much insecurity and anxiety. Serotonin is very important, because in sexuality, serotonin is what is produced together with endorphins as a result of a good feeling, as a result of enjoying the sexual experience, whether it's by oneself or with a partner. But when the sexuality comes over a teenager who is already unstable in his or her emotional life, this extra push can throw the kid off balance to such an extent that in order to support himself or herself, he or she resorts to an artificial sense of structure, which is the obsession. Obsession gives a lot of structure to the mind, because it's a constant repetition of a pattern that is a ritual. Ritual is a structure. And so sexuality is a ritual, whether it's by oneself or with a partner.
So what a person will do when you feel out of control, what do you tend to do? You tend to organize. Any of you who ever felt like you were losing your mind, there's a tendency to go somewhere and organize something. I'll clean up my room. I'll clean up the desk. See? So the nature of the mind is to say, if you feel out of control, organize. The nature of obsessive compulsive disorder is organize. Focus your thought. Phobias are the same thing. You become afraid of something, and it replaces these other feelings you have that you're not comfortable with. We're not born with the right equipment. We may be modern man and modern woman, but we don't have the mechanisms yet, because animals don't go through this. You know what I mean?
They only do if you put them in artificial
situations.
If you put, when you cage them up and you do things to them that are unnatural, they will exhibit the same dysfunctional behaviors. They will become obsessed, like a hamster, typical example on those wheels. The hamster will just keep rolling on the wheel.
So if a person goes to a psychiatrist and says, I have an obsessive compulsive disorder, the psychiatrist examines it. The psychiatrist gives you medication, and they will even talk to you, but they'll never talk to you about your childhood sexuality. They just don't. They don't include it. I don't know what's wrong. If you go to a therapist, talk about obsessive compulsive disorder, they will relate it to your anger, but they don't go to the childhood sexuality. And I tell you, there are some people who have a greater sexual awareness at early age than others do. And if you just happen to have that ultra sexy additional hormones, then your mind is going to go bonkers. Your mind is going to try to balance it if you're not in a nurturing environment. Now, if you're in a nurturing home where people look and love you and could let you be who you are, you don't have to go bonkers. And I say bonkers is really obsessing and thinking about crazy things all the time.
Isn't a drug, in a way, like a form of inner structure that is provided to you from the outside? Isn't that what it feels like to a person who is out of control with a disorder like that? A drug can feel like something, the piece that's missing, that piece that should support the structure that I seem to find in my compulsion, now is given to me by this chemical crutch, sort of. And it takes the place of that missing piece. But as you pointed out a while ago, I ask myself, well, if we take away this coping strategy the person has come up with, and replace it with a drug, okay, so for a while maybe things are going to be okay. But if we take it away what is it going to replace it? Once you take away the drug.
Well, it's a funny thing. What they've discovered about psychotherapy and taking chemicals, and by chemicals, I also mean nutritional awareness, Roberta. Nutritional consciousness. And
well, of course.
People are thinking I'm just talking about prescription medications.
Herbs, too, and especially amino acids, people. Amino acids are the precursors of all the neurotransmitters that we make day by day. And so by taking amino acids in a way that is not wise, people can actually do a lot of harm to themselves, because those are going to be made into neurotransmitters in excess.
But even taking them the wise way, green juice, cleaning yourself out, it's all a chemical adaptation. It's all trying to change your chemistry. And here's the idea. It's good to change your chemistry for the better. It's good to live in balance. We know that. But what are we saying about what's necessary? What is needed by this person who tends to have their mind go out to these crazy ways? Well, one of the things that you need to do is you need to talk about it. You need to get to the bottom of it. Psychotherapy itself may be effective. If a person talks to a counselor, that may be effective. Meditation may be effective.
Omega-3 fatty acids are effective. Because they are the structural fats that make up most of the brain and nervous system, and they are shown to be lacking in people with obsessive compulsive disorders.
And what you need is you need to find the bottom of it. You need to. I know that it's hard to admit it. I know we'd like to say, well, I'll just get past it. You need a skilled scientist who is going to work with you at getting to the bottom of your sexual beliefs, your adolescent ones, and where it went later. Now, I have met many people with obsessive compulsive disorders, and everyone I have ever met has a secret sexual fantasy life that borders on the bizarre. So, therefore, it's a place to discover. So what we're saying is it's not such a bad thing. I mean, it's a horrible way to live, phobic, obsessed, worried, spending your life chasing your tail. But there's a purpose in here. There's something that life wants. I read about, I was reading about the hurricane, the cyclone. I think I might have mentioned this. Cyclones in the Midwest. A cyclone comes from the perception by nature that there's an imbalance in the electrical structure of a particular area. Something is created where there's an imbalance. There's an imbalance of electrical charge. The cyclone comes in to create a spin to recharge that area. Now, it does it, and in its wake, it has a lot of destructiveness. But cyclones come in till the air is balanced. The minute the air is balanced, the cyclone stops. Now, what power? Think of this universal thing. I mean, tsunamis may be the very same thing, even though I don't mean to trivialize it. What is nature doing? What does nature have the power to do with a cyclone that along its way can create such destruction? Well, we have cyclones inside of us. And sometimes we hurt ourselves along the way. But if there's a way of detecting the imbalance and correcting the imbalance, we don't need the emotional cyclones. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. Let's think of addiction, Roberta, for a moment. Addiction as a way, an adaptation. Again, you know, you feel pain, you go numb.
Yes, addiction is another way in which I think one looks for a crutch. One looks for the missing piece as if it were to come from the outside. One learns a behavior also that changes the structure and the function of the nervous system in such a way that it becomes part of the survival mechanism of that individual. That is really the crucial aspect of addiction, Armand, that I need to point out, that once a person has been addicted, forever after, even if they stop using that substance or that behavior, the brain is wired in such a way that that particular addiction has now been integrated at the perceptual level, meaning it feels like it is needed for survival, like water, like food, like all of the things that are truly needed, except that this one is not truly needed. This is artificial. But because it becomes such a powerful survival driving force, addictions are dangerous, because when it comes to survival, we're all compulsive. You see, when we get down to that brainstem, to the basic brain that we share with the reptiles, no intellectual consideration, no rational mind, no reasonable thinking does anything down there. Down there, it's brutal survival and the need to fight for your life no matter what comes your way. And if addiction ends up being a tool that helps, and it does, Armand, because I've known a lot of people who have used an addiction as a way to survive intolerable conditions in their lives. If addiction becomes such a crutch, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to convince the brain that this is now something that we need to get rid of.
Well, you see, addiction is kind of an interesting thing because it's somewhere between life and death. Once again, you can hang out in an addictive process. Now, addictions could be anything from alcohol to sexuality to just any place where you're living in a numb land. So once you have an addiction, is the answer to dealing with your addictions just starve yourself from the addiction? Sure. Sure. You want to get off, you go cold turkey. The problem is this other stuff underneath it that's going to come up. Nobody wants to understand, or nobody wants to put the attention, or maybe nobody has the intelligence to ask the question, when did it start? Where did it start? What is it taking care of? What is it taking care of? What is this addiction doing for you? You know, let's see where it's serving you so that when we take you out of your substance, we're also paying attention to that other thing.
You know, Armand, often addictions serve the purpose of facilitating a fantasy that is a fantasy of love, of having a good life, of having a peaceful life, of having a good relationship, of having a loving experience. The addiction allows that fantasy, facilitates it, and one while is engaging in the addiction can temporarily pretend that that fantasy is somewhat real. And as we were discussing this morning when we were preparing for the show, we were saying all of that love in that fantasy that would express itself in that beautiful, exquisite, devotional way with, you know, love and peace and care and all of that, because it cannot be expressed in that way as it is in the fantasy, once it comes out of the fantasy and it becomes unreal, it can take on a very destructive, powerful urge. So the addiction keeps the fantasy, but it keeps, in a way, the destructive force at bay.
In many ways. You know, in many ways, I think if people didn't have these pathologies, they'd be dead. I think it's just a simple way of things. I think we should have a little celebration week. I think everybody who's got OCD should celebrate. And, you know, just the fact that it was there. Depression, celebrate that it was there. Celebrate that it's there because the human mind has tried its best to get through. Now, one theory is it's all a substitute for love. You know, one theory is if you're a child and you don't feel the connection with your roots and you don't feel a connection with your family, if you're like an automatic refugee from the day you're born or an orphan and you felt that way, your mind is going to try to take you somewhere to survive. And this is its purpose. And it is the absence of love that actually makes the pathology emerge as the substitute for love. Now, if you think about it, depression could be like a romance. You could be in love with your own depression. You could not want to come out of it. You could love your obsessions. You could love your addictions. But the theory falls apart when a person who is stuck in these things falls in love and they find a true love partner. One would imagine everything would disappear. All the problems would disappear, but they don't. Once you have made the choice of living the aberrant mental way, the way that your mind is going to be, and I'm saying many of us do it, even through character disorders, even through, you know, other things. It doesn't have to be really bizarre stuff. But once you make that step, love almost doesn't count anymore. It counts in a little way, but you still got to break through the original stuff. That's what I think. So I think one of the things that we've got to do is, number one, recognize that these pathologies, as they appear, almost anything that anybody has some kind of a purpose. Understand the purpose. Whether you take care of that
adaptation through adjusting your chemistry, by cleaning up your act, by exercising, by doing anything, or by taking drugs. Whatever you do, fine, but try to get the understanding behind it. And don't judge people. Don't judge people for the way they are. If you see somebody who is depressed, understand they're getting by as best they can. If you see somebody who's outrageously angry, understand they're getting by the best they can. Don't just react to their pathology with your own. Part of what we could do for people is understand them and love them.
I have a question for you, Armand. Is psychopathy something that one is born with, or is it something that develops as a result of this lack of love?
Well, you know, I don't mean to say your parents didn't love you enough, because sometimes, you know, people, they can have really loving parents, but the brain chemistry doesn't allow them to receive it right from pre-birth.
So that's congenital then?
Yes, it could be.
So one is born a psychopath?
Well, I'm not sure about that. It could be. I've seen that always kind of is always there with a person, the tendency, but I wish we had the time to go into that. We just don't. However, I think psychopathy serves as a culture. I think when you get somebody who is a random killer, in a way, he is expressing the hostility that is the repressed anger of the society around him. So even when one of your psychopaths become a politician who could randomly go killing cultures, somehow that is reflecting a need of the culture and society to deal with its own aggression, even though we blame the bad guy. You know what I mean? Mm. So it's a much bigger thing. It's not just an intellectual process, it's a heart process. This is Armand Demille with Roberta Atti, trying to say to you that there's ways we're trying to understand people and their extremes. Next week, by the way, I'm going to be getting together with Kenneth Kamler, who is a scientist who has studied people dealing with extremes. It's going to be fascinating. We'll be doing some programming around this. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 2 p.m., at 1 p.m., if you want a copy of today's program. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. If you want to look at our website, it's www.thepositivemind.com.
And my email address is roberta4health@aol.com, and it's the number 4, Roberta number 4, health.
Send me an email, friends. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear what you hear, what you think about what you've been hearing. Bye-bye for now. It's Armand at BrainLink.